Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi friends, you're listening to a live recording of the panel on the trans and bike race held at Look Mom Their Hands on Tuesday, the 31st of July.
So thank you everybody for joining us tonight. Can everyone hear me okay? Tonight we're just going to be discussing the trans and bike race. 2008 race finished in, how many weeks ago was it now? A month ago now? But it takes place in June and it goes from Astoria in Oregon to Yorktown in Virginia. And it's 4,200 miles. So it's a pretty hefty race. I took part in it myself in 2016. I did not finish it. I got hit by a car on the first day and fractured my collarbone and dislocated my shoulder, but I didn't realize and I kept riding for 2,500 miles. So I have some idea of what these guys went through. I can't speak about the end of the race because I never got there. I gave up after Colorado. Went home and got some much-needed rest. Doctor told me off. I don't think I've ever been yelled at by a doctor before, but if you go ride your bike with a broken shoulder, they don't really like that. But yeah, so I'm just going to pass the mic around so everybody can introduce themselves. We're going to talk for maybe half an hour, 40 minutes, and then just open it up to questions. So keep your questions stored for us. Frank?
Hi. So my name's Darren Franks. I finished in 22 days with the 12th fastest time. I took a small flight in the middle, so it's perhaps not official.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Stephen Pawley, finished in about 27 days, so pretty much the middle of the pack, and had a good time.
Hello, I'm Steve Haynes, did Trans Am in just under 21 days.
I didn't know you'd do it that quick. Well done, mate, that was really good. I'm George Driscoll, and me and Dan Tover here entered as a pair, as novices, and we did it in 35 days.
So I guess we'll just start right away with the lows. we'll just get right in there. So I want everyone just to tell me about sort of your worst day during the race. Keep it lighthearted.
My worst day would be day 10, I think, leaving Pueblo just after Ordway. I slashed a tire, had slashed the sidewall of my rear tire, and I was faced with an option: do I carry on, put a tire boot in and carry on about 350 miles towards Newton, or backtrack 70 miles back to Pueblo, get a new tire and fix that. So I had to make the decision and I went back to Pueblo, and at the same time I started getting knee problems. Was very frustrating. But some medication and a bit of stretching, that it sorted that out. But what should have taken, I think, 2 days to get from Pueblo to Newton, in the end took me 4 days as a result of having to backtrack, take it easy, and then gentle soft tapping across to Newton.
Worst day probably was learning about headwinds. Now, it's probably not the best time to learn about them, but it was awful. It was like cycling in syrup, going uphill, and you think you get to the top of the hill. At least when you get to go down the other side, you can just rest for a bit. But then you get to the other side, and there's so much wind, you're not going anywhere when you take your feet for a rest. So you have to keep on pedaling down, and then you realise you've got 100 miles of that. It just is very daunting. So that was probably the worst day for me.
Do you have a worst day?
My worst day would have been about day 5. We didn't really do much training. We didn't do as much as we should have done, actually. But I had a knee injury on the fifth day. So that whole day, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse. By the end of the day, I could barely bend my knee, like, at all. So I was thinking, like, the next day, in my head, I'd quit, basically, that day. So it basically, yeah, like I say, I quit at the end of that day, but then I basically carried on. And then it basically ended up getting better. I don't know how, but day five would have been worst day, definitely.
Sorry. Worst day for me was day seven. Stephen was there when it happened, actually. So I'd been suffering with a mechanical problem that I couldn't diagnose for a few days. And then we diagnosed it. it was a problem that I just could not fix on the road. So it meant scratching from the race, or we're kind of moving to Jackson Hole, waiting for a replacement bike. And that took 8 days to arrive. It's supposed to be a next day delivery, but it took 8 days. So I sat there for 8 days just watching the race get away from me. That was my low, definitely.
Well, I had a bad week more than, and it just was like Groundhog Day every day, Kansas, I think, which, yeah, the sort of the K word nobody wants to talk about. Headwinds, 40, 45 degree heat, straight roads, nothing to see, nowhere to get food. And I was kind of on my own, so I didn't see any riders for about 6 or 7 days, and was pretty demoralizing.
So the reason I wanted to start with that is because I kind of want to set the scene of how brutal these races can be from the beginning. And so I guess on to my next question for you guys is more about why you wanted to do this race in particular. Just heard it can get pretty miserable out there. So what is it that motivates you to do them?
I've done a couple of these races before, done the Transatlantic Way, done the Transcontinental. So they come a bit addictive, and you keep wanting to go longer and longer and see what you can do. And America was sort of the next one sort of flashing on the horizon. And it's somewhere that I've never really wanted to go to America. I've never really been attracted to the country. But the landscapes was something that I wanted to go and see, particularly in the first half of the race, through the Rockies down to Kansas. So that was the real motivation for me to do it. Why I do it, I don't know. I like the training part leading up to the race. I like the discipline that you need to get ready. And then I like to find out what I can do and what I can't do. And, you know, when it all goes wrong, that's when you really find out what you're made of, or how little you're actually made of. Because when it goes wrong, like I had problems with my knee, it's amazing how quickly everything can unravel psychologically. And it's that bit that I find quite interesting.
We wanted to do it after watching Inspire to Ride, and possibly a slightly rose-tinted version of the reality once you get there. But it just looked amazing, and Mike Hall's spirit coming off the screen, just so humble, but you knew really he was going through hell. And I just thought, what an amazing way to see such a diverse country. And neither Dan or I had really cycled at all, and we just thought, what a ridiculous, insurmountable challenge we'd want to take on and just get to the end. And Dan is incredibly strong mentally, I'm not so much, and I knew you'd have enough to carry us both to the end. So that's one of the reasons. And just to go back a step, the night where his knee was so bad that mentally he quit, if you know Dan, he just does not quit at anything. So I knew it must have been bad, because actually I was texting a few people advice on how to fix the knee problem. I think I might have texted you, Darren, and you might have said, like, try moving your saddle 2 millimeters or something like that. And I suggested that to Dan, and he looked at me like he was going to punch me in the face. And I just thought, oh, I'll just go to bed then. But the next day, and he didn't tell me at the time, but the next day he actually woke up knowing that he couldn't cycle on his knee, but had resolved that he's going to go as far as he could, and if that meant he wasn't going to walk right for the rest of his life, he was going to do it anyway. And that's kind of why we took on the challenge in the first place, was to stretch ourselves to, you know, beyond the limits of what we thought were capable. and Dan was rewarded with his knee gradually getting better because he did move his saddle 2 millimeters, and somehow that fixed the problem. So in a nutshell, that's why we started doing it. I don't know if you want to... Yeah.
Yeah, so I turned 40 in January, and stupidly in the depths of the UK winter, the end of last year, I thought, what can I do to celebrate? Obviously the wrong decision, having done TCR and some other long rides before, and I did remind myself for 16 hours every day that that was a silly decision. But yeah, why we do it, I don't think anybody knows why we do it, but we do.
I think the guys have covered most of it, to be honest. For me, I'm drawn to the extreme side of things. It's not pleasant while you do it. This is a very definition of type 2. This is not really fun while we're doing it, I don't think. I don't know if anybody else kind of actually enjoys the act itself. I don't think I do. But I like the place that it puts me into. I like to get fucked up and then it strips away all the nonsense that doesn't really matter, all the stuff that we kind of build up day to day that we think is important, and you realize probably day 2 or day 3 what is and what isn't, that all gets kind of dropped away, and then life just gets really, really simple. It's just about kind of moving forwards, finding food, finding shelter, staying healthy, and that's it. And it puts you in this meditative state where you get to, you're just free of all the baggage. You get to think very, very clearly, and that's a very rare thing today. So that's why I keep coming back.
I'm going to add a little bit too. I think for me personally, all the reasons you guys have touched on, you touched on a little bit, but I think it's part of the act of exploring as well. I mean, getting to see landscapes in a way that you would never get to otherwise. If you did a road trip across America in a car, you just would not get the same experience that you get on a bike. I think when you travel by bike, it's quite humbling because you are literally suffering through everything. Like, if the wind is strong that day, you feel it. If the gradient of the road is shit, like, you're pushing harder. And so you sort of have to feel like every moment of your journey, but it also makes you very unthreatening to other people. I think people see you on a bike and they kind of want to help you immediately because they're like, what the hell are you doing here? Like, how have you got to this obscure town
vulnerable, you do bring out the best in other people. The people are very, very keen to show you like as much hospitality as possible. That's a really lovely thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, in America, I found it more than anywhere that I've ridden, I think, was just some of the people and the conversations that I had. And I mean, so to put into context, because I got hit on the first, so I got hit 50 miles in on the first day, so I was kind of knocked out of the race from the beginning. I spent a day in hospital getting some stitches and bandaged up, and then had to go buy a new wheel and then restarted. So I was about 2.5 days behind the rest of the race from the beginning. So it was sort of about catching up, but I also just wanted, I was saying to the guys at the beginning when we were just chatting amongst ourselves, for me it was, I didn't go all that way and do all the training to just ride 50 miles and then fly back to the UK. So I think it was a bit of stubbornness, which I think probably everyone will agree is a trait that you need to have if you do these races. you got to be pretty stubborn. And so for me, that was kind of the motivation to keep going. But I was able to sort of spend my time kind of talking to people a little bit more. Like, I think I was averaging about 150 miles a day when I was doing it. So it's not as much as I'd hoped to, which meant I got to have some good conversations. But what kind of interactions, interesting people, craziness did you guys experience on the route this year?
So I was trying to push quite hard, so I didn't really have much time for interactions. It's always a tricky dilemma, kind of touring versus racing. You meet so many amazing characters, but you're always watching the clock, so you never get to really indulge. The few times where I did have some interesting interactions were probably the worst for my race. There was one guy, Crazy Larry in Damascus. That's his actual name. He's perfectly named. It was fascinating, but slow. I think that if you're gonna if you're going to tour, it's amazing to meet all these characters, but they don't necessarily lend themselves to racing. So.
Are there any Americans here? Because pretty much every interaction was a little bit interesting, but I tan quite well, and the only interaction I had, which I think afterwards was a bit unpleasant, maybe, was I was sitting in a gas station having some food, and this gentleman came and started asking me the usual questions about, you know, where I'm going and so forth. And he then asked me where my grandfather was from. I was like, okay. He was born in England. Okay. And your father? Well, South Africa. And then he said, are you sure? Like, are you sure you're not Hispanic? I'm like, dude, I'm definitely not Hispanic. So I showed him the tan lines, and he just sort of left it at that. But it's quite an interesting one.
For myself, one of the most interesting interactions was, I think, in Jeffrey City, which is a tiny place just after Saltwater Lake. And there's hardly anything there. There's a pottery shop, a bar, and a few dwellings. There's not much there at all. Went into the bar full of sort of rugged workmen having their steak dinners, and I walk in my lycra wanting some dinner and stuff, and there's just the guy behind the bar who looks at me chewing on a stick, asking whether I'm one of these speed racers sort of coming through, and then another chap from Wyoming who tells me that he rides a horse and he can ride it all day without seeing a single fence. I forget buildings or roads or anything like that, so just the vastness of the country. And then, of course, the dot watchers who come in and just stop you halfway through. They're always very interesting. Although I don't know how the other races felt, but Virginia, it seemed like they were hunting you down. Yeah. It was like a tag team. It was ridiculous. But so before then, they were sort of not very intermittent, and that was really nice. That was really cool.
Similar to you, me and Dan were a pair, and like you say, the Lycra doesn't really leave much to the imagination for a lot of people, and our team colours were pink, and like any time we went into a situation where it was a bit more of a cowboy sort of zone, there was literally a bar we went in that had saloon doors, and when we got in, there was about eight like Hell's Angel type bikers sat down, and I just looked at them, and I just thought, yep, and they all sort of looked at me, and they were like, yeah, he's one of those funny folk sort of thing. And there was a lot of moments like that, which was then confirmed by, there was a young lad about this big with a mullet, and he asked Dan if I was his boyfriend, and I was just like, because it's pink, which I thought was quite funny. And another situation is, we were caught out in a storm, because we always think we can just cycle through. Me, Dan, and actually we're cycling with Andrew at the time, he's just there. He'd never had chocolate milk before this situation, by the way, which is insane. And we were cycling through a storm, and there was lightning going off really close, and it was starting getting really heavy, really windy, and it started to feel quite dangerous. And a lady just pulled the window down and said, yeah, you should probably get out of the storm. So we did, and we went and sat on their porch, and she fed us macaroni and cheese, and the whole family came out, and they were so lovely. And then the father of the family was telling us how, like, what he does for fun, and he hunts, and he eats things. And he was telling me how he was driving home one day, and he saw a giant snapper turtle coming across the road. So him and his son jump out and wrestle this snapper turtle into the back of his truck. They take it home and they eat it. And he reckons afterwards, his dad told him, based on the size of the shell, that he reckons he was about 150 to 200 years old. And he said, and he goes, I almost felt bad about it. And I was just like, and I was trying to be quite outspoken. So I'd be like, what I really wanted to say was, you definitely should feel bad about that. But I was like, yeah, was it tasty? So there was a few moments like that, just different people.
I got a few moments like that. When I came through Wisdom, I stayed in a bed and breakfast that night. And as I walked in, the lady who ran the bed and breakfast had big vats of, I don't know, whatever you dissolve the flesh off animal bones in to taxidermy them. So she basically had these big vats and was like dipping whole deer into them. And I'm vegan. And so it's kind of like, I'm like, you know, do your thing. That's cool. But I'm just going to kind of slowly sink away. And I was like, oh, is there anywhere to eat nearby? And she's like, well, I've got some deer. And I was like, no, I'm good. Like, anywhere else? And in the there was a bar in town, and it literally has a sign above the bar that said, we shoot vegetarians. And I'm like, okay, cool. So how am I going to order something vegan without telling them, like, that I don't eat meat or cheese? So I ordered a ham and pepperoni, or ham and pineapple pizza with just the pineapple and no cheese and no ham, which... got some strange looks, but managed to get some food. So speaking of food, what's the best thing you ate and what's the weirdest thing you ate on the race?
The best thing was breakfast on day 3 in Baker City. Huevos Ranchos or something like that. But it had vegetables, which was the first vegetables in 3 days. And it was great, and eggs and all sorts. That was really good. And then after that, it didn't get too interesting, to be fair. It was just the usual mix of service station nonsense and fast food. But just chocolate milk was mentioned earlier. When I left Lolo in the morning and stopped off at a service station before Chief Joseph passed, and I bought a carton of chocolate milk. But America, it's big cartons, and this thing was huge. But I'd bought it, so I was going to drink this chocolate milk. And... it had 2.5 days worth of saturated fat intake, which I had drunk, and got back on the bike, and the blood had just rushed to my stomach, and I was feeling a bit unwell. And without getting too graphic, I ended up with chocolate milk splashed on my socks. It couldn't stay.
Well, snapper turtle is delicious. I can tell you that for nothing. The worst part of it is just the lack of vegetables, and like every menu and every diner, like you get there, because I've been diet, I lost like 14 kilograms in preparation, so my diet had been really restricted, and I was just salivating over waffles and chicken and things like that, and 2 days in, you're just like, for the love of God, are there no vegetables on any menu? It's like, nothing. It's just pancakes, maple syrup, bacon, fried chicken the whole time. So like, actually, one of my favorite things ended up being like a can of V8 vegetable juice, because it just... felt incredible, which is ridiculous, but that's how, you know, scarce vegetables were. So
there was another storm situation on Luxor, going up to, I don't know if you remember that. We were riding pretty much all day in rain and drenched through. We got to the top of Luxor Ridge, where we were staying for that night, and they were just closing the bar up, and the woman basically put us together a ham sandwich. It was a shit ham sandwich, like, but it was the best ham sandwich at the same time. So, yeah, that was my best food, a shit ham sandwich.
I think for me, the highlight, I love a milkshake when I'm racing. Kind of cold, liquid, fatty carbs, just perfect. America's pretty good for milkshakes. Although there was a heat wave happening through Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, and Virginia. So... despite getting into these hot states where they had dairy bars and milkshakes on tap, they'd all run out of ice cream. So that was a challenge. But the rest of America was actually pretty boring for food. It's not like the Transcontinental, which like three of us have done already, where there's this huge variety. America was pretty much the same thing all the way across. So it's hard, I found, to avoid eating too much protein, which is, you know, just slows you down, just grinds everything up. So trying to find veg, some colours, and then avoid too much protein. That was the hard part.
Well, sort of the first week, I was struggling with keeping food down, and I had a Mexican, and that set it off, I think. But I moved on to a liquid diet, and I discovered after sort of getting a bit bored of Coke, I discovered the soda fountain machines in these petrol stations. And I also discovered Mountain Dew, which is an amazing drink if you've ever had it. It's got more caffeine than Coke. It's got more sugar than Coke. It's brilliant. Plus, the cup sizes are in the US are fantastic. I mean, I went and, you know, this is nothing. You know, you get these 32-ounce jobbies and you put a bit of ice in it. And then, I sarcastically said, oh, don't you have a bigger one? And the lady said, oh, yeah, of course we do. They got like 44-ounce, 52-ounce, 100-ounce, whatever you want. It's like, it's brilliant. Really good and cheap, only about 89 cents for a mahoose of
They have, they're huge, and they had the half iced tea, half lemonade ones. And literally every store I'd go into, I'd down like two or three of those before I even thought about food.
I do have one actually I thought about. I don't drink coffee. I just don't like coffee, but I got a taste for iced lattes because it was the only thing that was available in one shop. And then there was a point in the race where I stopped at a service station sometime in the morning, and there was just nothing I could get to eat. So I ended up buying it was a big box of Cocoa Pops. And I had a bowl of Cocoa Pops, and instead of milk, I used a latte.
What's the one thing that you learned about this race that you would take into other, like about either your setup or yourself, that you would take into your next race? If you do another one.
For me, this was the first race that I've done where I didn't consider myself a rookie. So I've done a few before this and made all the mistakes. So this one was about taking everything that I'd learned. And the biggest lesson that proved to be successful was about pacing and recovery. So I take my recovery very, very seriously when I'm racing now. So I use a routine, and I'm very precious about my sleep. So I've learned over the years that I can't get good sleep in a hedge. Or a bus stop. So now I prioritize finding good quality rest. So usually a hotel, it's only for 4 hours, but 4 hours of good quality rest is enough for me, whereas 8 hours in a bus stop just doesn't really do anything. So, I made it 7 days before the bike problem, but I felt fresh as a daisy after 7 days, even on 4 hours sleep. So I think for me, getting a routine and having quality sleep, that was the biggest difference.
Yeah, I think I learned not to race again, having done the TCR and other things before. I think the things I do regret are certainly, you know, taking your time and meeting people and seeing things along the road. You know, I've seen other people's photographs and their interactions with people and their, what they're eating for lunch, and it looks amazing. And when you're trying to race every day and trying to do 200 miles, you're not eating.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, you're not sleeping well. You know, not, you know, things are going wrong. You're grumpy. You're tired. And it's the enjoyment factor isn't there. And, you know, not to put anybody off, you know, I think the races are amazing. But having done a couple of them, I think, you know, yeah, maybe that's just me. But, you know, slowing down and seeing a bit of the world is also good fun.
Not dissimilar to Darren. I like structure. I can only cycle long distances with a decent amount of sleep and structure. I can't go through the night like some people and just survive on 1 hour sleep. That's for a different person. And I've learned that, so I stuck to my plan. That was really good. What would I do differently? I would take less clothing, or just buy better clothing, so I wouldn't have to double up, just to cut down a bit on weight, and more gearing on the bike. I had a 1-1 ratio, but I would have gone a bit lower.
Well, me and Dan were learning everything really on the fly, and we were absorbing whatever advice we could, wherever it came. And I met Darren a couple of days before we left, and one of the things he said really stuck with us and then became a mantra probably for the second half of the race, which was time in the saddle, or tits, if you want to look for the acronym. And so then it was just like every day we got, right, we've got to get up, we've got to get some great tits today. We've got to get it, make sure we get them in the saddle. So then that became like a jovial way of like just making light of the situation, because it really does come down to time in the saddle, because it doesn't really matter how much, if you're pushing yourself that little bit more for 2 hours, it makes such little difference to the 20 minutes you spend off your bike in a gas station. It's just time in the saddle. And then the more time went on, the less time we spent out of the saddle, the more in it, and the better rest we got, because we were afforded that time in the evening. So thanks, Darren. That really paid dividends.
Okay, I know it's super hot, so I'm going to start opening it up to questions to the audience.
One question. Three of you have done the Transcontinental and the Transamerica. How do they compare?
They're very different. Very, very different. So on paper, it looks like the Trans Am is harder because it's so much longer. So for reference, the Transcontinental that's happening now is about 4,000 kilometers. The Trans Am is roughly 7,000. But I think the Transcontinental is significantly harder. It's a different country every day. It's different food, a different currency. The geography changes so quickly, and the route is not fixed. So there's that extra element of adventure to it. I find it much more raw. Not to underplay the Trans Am, it's a hell of a thing, but. But I think the TCR is probably a step up.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I mean, the route for the Trans Am, as Darren said, is planned. So you can just turn up and ride and focus on other things, you know, getting your equipment right and that sort of thing. Whereas the Transcontinental, you can spend 3, 4, 5 months planning routes. And because the road networks in Europe, so, you know, there's so many options. You literally take months of planning.
There's so many more ways to fuck up on the Transcontinental.
Yeah, the TCR is more interesting because there are all the different route options. But with the Trans Am, you're all on the same route. So it's a basic time trial, which again adds its own sort of dynamic to it. Trans Am, I hesitate to say it, but there are 3 miles. There are easier miles to be had than in Europe. It's up and down. It can be logistically, it's different with languages, with currency, with understanding what's on the menus, that sort of thing. Whereas in America, you can just go, and yes, you end up in eastern Colorado and Kansas, and it's flat. But it's flat, so just it's easy to ride. Okay, there'll be some winds, there'll be some crosswinds, but you just deal with that. You're not, you know, suddenly finding yourself in some horrendous hill in Slovenia that you didn't expect. Trans Am is probably easier. Yeah.
I think one more thing though is that on the Trans Am there are much longer distances where there's nowhere to resupply. Places are closed. Don't forget that the route you follow on the Trans Am is about 40 years old, and a lot of the little towns and things that you go through are pretty much ghost towns now. So you may expect when you see on the map that there's a place you might be able to get some food or something, and you roll in, and it's literally deserted. Everything's boarded up. You know, there's no water for 100 miles or something like that. So there are those things to consider as well.
Yeah, I found that a lot too. Was when I did it, there was a heat wave, and so just getting water was really difficult on the Trans Am. Like I found, I was just basically letting myself get dehydrated because I was too afraid to drink the water I had on my bike because I knew I wouldn't be able to resupply as much as I was going to need. I don't know if you guys found that this year as well, but there would be times you come into a town and it'd be like, you'd be so excited that you're like, yes, I've hit that checkpoint mentally that this is where I'm going to be able to get food and water and like have a little break. And you'd get there and it's like, the store's open on Wednesday and it's Tuesday. And you're like, okay, another 80 miles and then I'll get my food and water.
Yeah, I
need a lot of liquid. So I just carried an insane amount of Gatorade on me. I mean, it's incredible. So at sometimes it was 4 liters of the stuff just on various parts of the bike just to make sure I didn't get dehydrated.
Well, I didn't do the
transcontinental. Well, no, you know, if you just have a thought, you can add it.
Drink lots of water. That's really good advice. And similar experiences, it will say, like, something city, and you think, oh, thank God for that. And you'll get there, and it's just, you know, it's just empty. So, yeah. But, I mean, especially during the latter half in the Ozarks when there was a heat wave going on, that was new to us as well. And the you didn't realize how much water can come out of your body so quick. And, like, you look down after a couple of hours, and you're like, it's like you've just stepped out of a shower. It's ridiculous. And then you're just drinking so much, and then you forget about your electrolytes, and you get dizzy. So that was a huge learning curve for us as well.
Any other questions?
What are your next bike plans? So I think, as Stephen, you've already gone through some of the downsides of racing. So are you more interested in now doing racing or more adventure, slow-paced things?
I'm pretty much retired from cycling now. That's it. That's how I feel anyway. But, you know, it's a good question, because you when you finish these races, I mean, the initial feeling you get is, I never want to do that again. I think we all have the same idea there. And within about a week or two, you're really looking for the next high. So there's, you know, the Transatlantic Way, or, you know, trying to get onto the TCR, or, you know, there's now a multitude of new events popping up. So me personally, yeah, I think a bit of touring maybe, and a bit of, as I said, to try and go and see some other things. You know, I've cycled Africa already and a few other continents, so I think it would be enjoyable, but it's still a bit too fresh. The scars are still open at the moment, so I think I'm going to leave it for now.
Sort of similar. I'd like to do some touring. Having raced for the last few years, it would be nice to take the pressure off and to have the opportunity to enjoy those interactions, you know, stop in places that you fall in love with and take your time over it. But I think next year's likely to be, it's a Paris-Brest-Paris year, which comes around every 4 years. So that's a 1,200-kilometer race. That's much shorter. It's the sort of distance you... if you're going to win it, you won't sleep. You just do that in one go. So that might be the target next year. But I'm not done with racing. I feel like this year the Trans Am was supposed to be my test to see all of the things that I've learned. Now that I'm not a rookie, you know, where do I really stand in the pecking order of things? And that wasn't going to happen this year with the problems that I had. So, I'd still like to do another TCR. I'm looking at my wife. She's scowling at me now. I'd still like to do a TCR to figure out where I stand in the order of things. But that's probably not going to be next year.
Do you guys want to do another race?
I mean, well, as novices, we were like, we're going to do this. That's probably going to be it for us, and maybe we'll try something else. And not to dip the mood too much, but like halfway through, even though I loved the whole experience, like, there were accidents and there were things that happened along the way that really can get in your head. And some of the drivers are awful, which can get in your head. And halfway through, I have to say, like, I told myself I was never going to do it ever again. But we were just laughing in the car on the way down. I was like, how far is it around the world? I don't know. I'm not sure. But we've been eyeing up the TCR, looking at that, because sounds like it's harder, and we don't want to go easier, so we want to see if there's something that can break us. So we're thinking TCR next.
I'll do something next year. I think I know what it's going to be. Depends how much time I get off work, but I'm at a point where I've got a bit of momentum. If I stop and take a year out, I'm just worried. Well, not worried, but, you know, that it might not come back. So whilst I've got some momentum, I'll do something else next year. Not sure what. And then after that, maybe stop.
maybe not.
We'll see. That's I had a year off last year. You can come back. Don't worry. I think I'm going to do PBP as well. Paris Press Paris is on my list. And then Japanese Odyssey if they run it again next year, which is 2,500 kilometers around Japan. It looks really, really hilly, like really hilly. So I think that's my thing now, which it's not at all. You had a question, didn't you?
Just a quick one. Riding around London, you get loads of like near misses with cars, lorries, etc. Were there any moments where your heart sort of stopped and thought, "Ooh, that was close"?
About three in 4,200 miles. One logging truck that passed quite close. I had a mirror on the left handlebar, so you could see when they were coming and if another vehicle was coming from in the other direction, so you could kind of brace yourself or just take it easy and be ready. But there was one close pass with a logging truck and then two recreational vehicles towing yachts or small boats. The weekends were the worst. So Hoosier Pass on Sunday, everyone bombing up there on the Sunday morning. They weren't very, they didn't like the cyclists too much. And then on the last morning again, getting overtaken by a car towing a trailer. They're not aware of what they're doing. The professional drivers, they'll give you the space. Over all of America, I didn't feel unsafe. Riding in London is much worse. And I commute in London, so on the bike, and that kind of you get used to it, so it wasn't worse.
Probably about two or three times actual heart-stopping moments, but I think I probably felt it over longer periods of time compared to yourself. Like I say, when you hear about people who are getting hit further along in the race and you're coming up to those areas, it's really hard to keep those thoughts out of your head, depending on the kind of person you are. And with the RVs, because they rent the RVs, you see. So the people that aren't necessarily used to the size of their vehicle, so they don't have that spatial awareness. So, and you're aware of that. And like I said, I have a mirror so you can see them coming. And I did ditch once or twice to get out of the way. But it was more the long-term uncertain. It'd be a whole day of thinking, you're bracing just a little bit more tightly than you ordinarily would. But then there are massive stretches where you've got huge shoulder with great rumble strips that would wake any driver up. So it swings and roundabouts for me. I can't really compare it to London, but there were some like whole days really of where it gets in my brain. But that's just me. You might be more buoyant and stronger than me. I don't know. So
one sticks out in my mind was a logging truck. It got like that close that I could feel the heat off the engine. It was that close. Like so, that was the worst one.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with these gents. It was literally two or three incidents within 3.5 weeks, 4,000 odd miles, and in some of the states, the drivers actually would sit behind you. They wouldn't hoot. They wouldn't overtake you. They wouldn't go onto the other side of the road because it was a solid line, and they'd just sit patiently while you're going up this hill for like miles. Literally, and it got annoying after a while. It's like, please come past. Like, you wave these guys past you and they wouldn't move. So there were extremes, but you also get used to people passing you and literally going to the other side of the road to pass you. That when somebody comes as close as they pass you in London, then you sort of, you know, it's just that relative measure. But I think, you know, commuting into town every day, I mean, you basically have close calls every day. And in the US, it was fine.
Same story. So riding in London, probably every other ride, I'll have a close call. I did a ride at the weekend. I had four just in London. And across the states, I didn't ride in Kansas. I had to shortcut that part. That's the worst state. But across the rest of the distance, I only had one incident, and that was in Kentucky. Kentucky was actually what I would say is the safest state to cycle in. Even the guy who threw a beer can at me did it from the other side of the road. You know, he gave me a full lane. and then threw a beer can at me. The one incident I had was in a really intense storm. I was on a dual carriageway, really, really wide shoulder, like the shoulder, you could fit a truck in the shoulder. And I'm driving, riding along, and this car came across the central reservation to come and pull into some stores on this side. And he was literally just cutting across the road straight at me. And I just happened to be looking down at my computer at the time. Then I looked up and I'm like, fuck, there's a truck coming straight at me. And luckily, we both swerved in the right direction. But that was touch and go. Yeah.
Hi. So I'm in about 6 weeks doing Ride Across Britain and terrified. And I'm in that packing list phase. So what's the one thing that you had in your bags that might not have been the, should we say, mandated essential, but that you couldn't live without?
My rock. For me, it's about keeping your head in the game. So actually, probably my phone as well. I really enjoy social media and doing stupid things on Twitter and Instagram, but I found a pile of rocks in Idaho with a sign that said free rocks, and I was like, can't pass that up. So I didn't pick the biggest one, obviously, but I picked up a rock and painted it to look like Sylvester Stallone and carried that across the States, and that was my thing. I was going to get that thing all the way to Yorktown. Anything that kind of keeps your head in the game, that's going to be important.
One item, two words, chamois cream, and lots of it.
And Asos repair gel for the evenings. You'll carry whatever you feel you need, depending on your level of risk. Personally, I had a couple of little mementos that was given to me, and it's when the going gets tough, you sort of revert back to those little keepsakes that were given. To see you safely across, or whatever they may be, because you'll have whatever you want, you'll take whatever you want. But what do you need when it gets really tough? And you know, it's been mentioned, it's physically you can do it, but mentally, when it gets tough, what do you need to see you through that? So that's important.
Well, me and Dan kind of obsessed about cutting as much weight as possible before we went, so we just erred on the side of caution. I mean, we'd even chopped our toothbrush in two, which sounds ridiculous, but you think that's probably at least 5-10 grams in that, and then it all just like adds up. And then as we were leaving, we had a big family dinner before we went away, and Dan descends from Vikings, so our joke team name was the Vikings, and our family's made up a medallion with the Vikings on it, and they're all really happy giving it to us, and they handed it to us, and I was like, oh, thanks so much, and I was like, how much do you reckon that weighs? I'll just leave that there. But no, I took him in the end, and it was a real good mental reminder of the team spirit between me and Dan, and like why we were doing it, and that you're also riding for another person. So that's kind of a different dynamic for me and Dan, for the rest of the guys, that we were riding for the other person the whole time as well. So that was something that egged us along. So I think a symbol of our team was something that really worked for me.
My one luxury item that I always take with me is compression leggings. And I sleep in them at night because I just find they help my legs recover faster. And it is like a total luxury item, but it's the one thing that I think for me at the end of the day, like just getting out of your bib shorts and being able to put like something else on is quite nice. And then I have a bracelet that's engraved with something my dad used to always say to me when I was racing. So that kind of, I always wear that as well, which is kind of, as you guys are saying, that like kind of memento to keep your head in the game.
Your head will go away before
your body
does.
Oh, yeah.
Can you guys please talk a bit about what kind of training you do and whereabouts?
This year, not a lot. I had two major mechanicals sort of last autumn. In September, I ended up with both bikes off the road, and then we were moving house. It was crazy work period. There was lots of other stuff going on. So I didn't ride at all until January, and then I was very short of time this year. Weather was foul, we were traveling a lot, so not a lot of training actually. But generally, it's not really about the physical training. You need some conditioning, you need a good base, you need to be able to stay on the bike for a long time, but it's not about being super fast. You'll save much more time by being efficient. So the sort of things that you would want to prioritize really are, I used to do a lot of rides where you go out with no food. You just scavenge for whatever you can find in petrol stations. Get used to doing that. And always, so my computer, I have the biggest field is set for the pause time. So I'm constantly looking at that. If I go and stop and grab some food somewhere, I take the computer with me, I sit that there, and I've got this clock just ticking at me, reminding me not to stay too long. But I don't think you need to do long rides for physical training. You need to do them to learn what happens with digestion, with fit issues and all this sort of stuff. Because what happens after 12 hours and what happens after 24, 48, 30, whatever hours is very different. But in terms of actual training, once you've done those rides, I think shorter, harder rides are going to be better for you. So I would, if you haven't done that, obviously you need to do the long rides to learn what happens, but I would prioritize speed work if you're thinking of trying to be competitive.
Yeah, I think just to sort of add on what Darren was saying, in terms of these kind of rides, it's also, you know, efficiency on how you've packed your bike and practicing that. So, you know, you can lose a lot of time, you know, unpacking your things and sleeping and waking up and packing up again. And, you know, you can be up, I can wake up and be ready to go within 10 minutes. And, you know, the other riders are faffing around in the morning and you lose a lot of time. And that's kind of, you know, practicing that, whereas the riding is the riding. But, you know, base miles, commuting to the office or whatever is I find that is enough for me, so.
I've done some long rides, so I know that that's all achievable. So for Trans Am, it was shorter, high-intensity efforts. The longest ride in training was 150 miles. I did use a coach to set the training plan, just because I wanted to take it more seriously this year and see what I could do. And so there was 4 turbo sessions a week, plus Saturday, Sunday rides, plus commutes. So it just built it all up. It's true. It's key. Time is key. So I've got ride time and pause time. I don't have miles an hour. I don't see that at all on the computer, which is frustrating when you stop the day at 198 miles, and the next day at 199 miles, and then 2 days later it was 299 miles, and you think, I could have just gone around the block, got an extra mile.
It's quite an expensive way to train, but there is a training program called the Trans Am Bike Race, if you want to do that. That's pretty much what me and Dan did. Like, we did about 2,000 miles in the 2 years before we went, and it was stupid, really, because it was a hard hit to our bodies beforehand. But actually, like these guys are saying, and like I'm really glad that they're saying it as well, it's mostly mental. And like once you've done a couple of long rides, I mean, it's just about it's time in the saddle. That's what we learned towards the end of it. It's all about getting used to just cutting down the time off the saddle. That's the main thing that we learned. And we did do, if you're like a novice, we did do a ride from Paris to Lisbon. We took all our gear, and that was the year before. And that actually was a really big learning curve, because we wanted to do 100 miles a day, which we didn't quite hit. We realized we were carrying a load of kit that we didn't need. We start to understand what happens to the body after about 7 or 8 days. So that's not alien to you if you're going on a long ride. And so even when we're on the Trans Am, after about 8 days, you know, we were suffering, like our bodies were beat. But we knew that we were going to cross a barrier where everything just kind of made sense and woke up. So mentally knowing that that period was coming was a huge mental advantage for us. Which I think that other people perhaps didn't have. Some people hadn't gone for more than 4 or 5 days, like other novices. And I think mentally for them, that would have been a harder barrier for them to go through. So like anyone who asks me now, I would definitely say, try and plan like a 1,000-mile ride with the gear that you're going to take and ride in the way that you think you'll be racing on the race. I would say, as a rookie, that is definitely what saved me and Dan, because we knew we could do it, and then we started getting lazy with the training after that. And we... was like, oh, it's a little bit cold in it, so we just stay inside, like, I'm going to do 20 minutes in the gym, it'll be fine. But we did suffer for it. We could have trained better, but I would 100% say do a 10-12-day ride so you understand your body better and you know how you diet and time on the saddle and that sort of stuff.
Anyone else? Okay, I guess we'll wrap it up. I think most of us are going to be sticking around for a little bit if anyone has any questions that they want to come and ask us personally. But thank you all for listening, and let's give these guys a round of applause.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.